Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name's Andrew Bopel, and today I am presenting a very special episode of Final Draft. I'm going to be handing over the reins to Felix Shannon, and he is sitting down with Pip Williams. Now, as we get started, I want to let you know about the Final Draft Podcast. We are about books, writing, and literary culture. Every week, Final Draft broadcasts from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. And here at Final Draft, we are dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to the classics that you know and love. And in each of these conversations, we look at the issues that drive the author's storytelling to help you discover more from the books you love, because these are the stories that make us who we are. Now, 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people. I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging that these are unceded lands and that treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. Now, as I mentioned before, I'm going to be handing over the reins to Felix Shannon. Many of you will know and love Felix's work. You can catch him over on, well, I guess we might say Final Draft Sister Podcast, our co-travellers in the literary world, Death of the Reader. Go check them out if you are looking for an incredible mystery journey. But for today, Felix is going to be joined by Pip Williams. Pip is the celebrated author of The Dictionary of Lost Words, and she is going to be joining Felix to talk about her new book, The Bookbinder of Jericho, taking us to Oxford in the interwar period. This promises to be just as well loved as The Dictionary of Lost Words. I cannot wait to hear this conversation. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand over to Felix Shannon and Pip Williams as they discuss The Bookbinder of Jericho.
Pip Williams is an Adelaide-based academic turned author. Her first novel, The Dictionary of Lost Words, captures the incredible voices of women often left out of the history of the creation of the Oxford English Dictionary. Her latest, The Bookbinder of Jericho, returns us to Oxford through the eyes of another woman, Peggy Jones, who has been told her whole life that her place is to bind books, not read them. As the First World War breaks out, barriers for women like Peggy change in shape, and censorship is more than a black line. How is Peggy's world altered as the trauma of war bleeds over the home front? Pip, welcome to Final Draft. It is wonderful to have you here on 2SER.
So great to be here. And that was
just a beautiful introduction.
That could be the blurb.
Well, part of it was from the blurb, so I can't take too much credit for it.
Not all of it.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how the novel got started. When the controller, Mr. Hart, leaves the bindery in chapter 17 in this book, the bindery staff sign their name on the farewell address, and Peggy has worked with this guy for 9 years, and she notes that her stitching in this gift will outlast every person who has signed their name. Finding that list of names in the archives is what you credited in the author's notes with solidifying the concept for the book. How was it to write that scene after the huge journey you've been on since that moment in the archives?
It was really beautiful because one of the things about writing about women who are not famous, women who have not been recorded in the history books, and often women who don't even exist in the archives, is that their names are never written down. In their lifetime, they're never written down. And in fact, the first time so many of us have our name written down is on our gravestone when we die. And that's actually something that hit me when I was doing my research in Jericho and Oxford as well, because I spent a lot of time at one of the cemeteries in Jericho looking at the headstones, and that struck me that many of the people there never had any recognition or acknowledgement. And when I was in the archives at Oxford University Press looking for information about the women who bound the books, I found very little. But what I did find was that it's called an address to Horace Hart. It was essentially a sort of farewell card to the boss of the bindery. And everybody who worked in the press at that time signed it. Of course, a lot of signatures are missing because so many of the men had gone to war. But in there are more than 50 signatures from the women who worked in the bindery. And I realised that's the one and only time their names had been written down for preservation. It was incumbent upon me to honour them.
Well, yeah, and it's also such a powerful moment too, I think, because as well as them not being remembered at any point, we have this big bifurcation of the entire bindery. There is the girl's side and the men's side, not the women's side.
That's right.
And like just the simple language of that, because I know there was, for example, one book, Mary Van Cleek's Woman in the Bookbinding Trade, that you were fortunate enough to stumble on a copy of. Like, is that something that was prevalent in more binderies than Oxford?
Yes. And in fact, I had a lot, in order to write this book with authenticity, I sought out a friend, what's become a friendship with the bookbinder at the State Library of South Australia. And his name's Peter Zajcek. And Peter actually joined the bindery at the library when he was 15 years old, and he's now in his 60s. And there were 52 people in the bindery then, and it was divided into the men's side and the girls' side, a very similar layout set up to Oxford University Press. And now he's the only bookbinder at the State Library. They are a rare breed these days. But because he had all of that experience, not just of binding books, so he could show me all of the processes so that I could write them with authenticity, because I've done them myself. I've handled the pages. I've sewn sections. But also he had access to information that I wouldn't have been able to find. And he found that book you're talking about, which was published in 1913. It's quite unique in that it was a female social scientist, and I used to be a female social scientist.
Yeah.
I'm still some of those things, which was quite rare at the time. And she employed female research assistants to talk to women in binderies in America. But the setup was very similar. It was a report essentially that was given to government to try and change the working conditions of women in printing houses around that country. But it gave me so much insight, and it was another example of where working women who normally would never have their words written down actually have quotes in this research report. So I can hear the voices of these working women. And I translated some of their experiences to the British experience because when I was in the archives at Oxford University Press, I could find very little of the women's voices. But I did find other things. I found some photographs of women folding the pages. So I had a sense of what the girls' side of the bindery looked like, all of those piles of paper and the gathering benches and so on. And probably the most, I suppose, inspirational bit of archival material that I was given access to was a film. And it's called, you can actually find it on YouTube. I think it's called The Making of a Book at Oxford University Press. It runs for about 20 minutes, and probably 19 of those minutes are about what the men do at the press. But there's a minute, I think, of women folding pages and one woman gathering the sections of a book onto her arm. And she's so graceful. It's obvious she's done this thousands of times. And as I was watching it, I suddenly had this sort of goosebumpy moment where I wondered, does she ever stop and read what she's gathering? And that's essentially where this story starts.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk a little bit about the women in the trade there as well, because Peggy and Maud's mother was also a binder, and Peggy has this tool that she has inherited from her mother since she passed away. We see so little directly of her other than the tool and the impression that she's left on the two girls. So what was it like trying to, I guess, sculpt the physical identity of this character when she's not really there?
You've kind of described it beautifully, and I'm going to borrow some of your words from now on. When you said this impression that she's left on the girls, that's exactly it. So the tool you're talking about is a bone folder. A bone folder essentially looks like a tongue depressor, but one end is a little bit more pointy. It's about the same size as a tongue depressor, and it's made of cowboy bone. And it's a tool that is used in every aspect of bookbinding. So the women use it to create a fold and make a really crisp edge. They also use it to separate, to open up a section when they're sewing. The men use it in all sorts of processes in terms of binding and casing in and covering a case in leather. It's used in so many different ways. It's the simplest thing, but a bookbinder would probably be given a bone folder when they start as an apprentice. And in Peggy and Maud's case and their mother's case, that would have been at the age of 12. Mm. And they'd have that bookbinder their entire life. And one of the things I kind of imagined, but also was given kind of confirmation of this from the bookbinder that I know, is that even though they're made of bone, it's that the constant handling for hours and hours and hours every day creates a kind of imprint in the bone folder. A bit like, you know, when you're traveling in Europe and you go down a set of stairs and there's an impression of all of the people who've walked on these stairs over 900 years sometimes if you're in one of those old cathedrals. It's a little bit similar to that. Very, very, very subtle. I kind of imagined it like, you know, your mother's wooden spoon that she might have had her whole life to cook with, or someone's axe handle, something like that. It holds the memory of a person who might not be there anymore. And that's what the bone folder is for Peggy. She inherits the bone folder because their mother has died. She died about 3 years before this story starts. But she is throughout the story. And I'm hoping that, you know, as the story goes along, we learn just enough about their mother to understand Peggy a little bit better.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was really fascinated reading that there are still longboats in the UK that people live on as a regular thing. Like, that's something you sort of think is a more, I guess, mainland Europe on the cities that are known for their rivers.
Yeah.
And finding out, like, the way that the Calliope sort of is another part of their mother's identity. Like, there's the room of hers that they don't open up, and the table and chair and all of the books that they've collected and left there that are like offcuts
from
the bindery.
So they're actually narrow. I'll call it, they're narrow boats. There is a difference between a long boat and a narrow boat, but a narrow boat is one of those canal boats that now, if you visit the UK is covered in canals, not in quite the same way that the Netherlands might be. But it's got a canal system because that actually used to be its industrial transport system. Bricks, timber, goods were all transported around the country via the waterways. You know, during the Industrial Revolution, that started to contract, and by the early 20th century, there were fewer and fewer narrow boats working the waterways and starting to increase people living on narrow boats permanently in single locations. And so my characters live on a narrow boat on the Oxford Canal. There's a very small community of people who live there. And the narrow boat was important because, first of all, I did so much research in Oxford, and the canals are just so attractive. I was drawn to them, and I imagined my characters living on the canal. And at that time, very different to today, living on a narrow boat would have been the cheapest way to live. And my characters were the children of a single mother, which would have been a life of poverty, essentially. Even though they had a job, they would have been paid less than the men at the press. And so she was Peggy's mother was trying to support her twin daughters on a single woman's income. And so the narrow boat made sense. It would not have been a comfortable experience on the whole. There's no toilet. There's no electricity. There's no running water. But on the other hand, the way they turn this narrow boat into a home and fill it with books, but also sections of books, unbound books, faulty books, books that have been discarded because they're not perfect, that turns it into something, I think, I felt as I was writing it, quite a magical place to dwell. And for me, writing this book and the last book, it was actually important that I enjoyed the process. And creating those spaces, those places, was for me part of the joy of writing these stories.
Yeah, I guess the thing that I wanted to drag us into there is that one of the things that the narrow boats are used so effectively for is Maud as a character, because she is, if you were to read it extremely cynically, a character that sort of doesn't have a voice of her own, because she largely just repeats things that have been said to her verbatim. But there is so much voice to her through what she chooses to say. And I love the narrow boats as a catalyst for that, because as you say, they're very stripped back. There's not a lot going on, and there's this small community of them where it's never really said explicitly in the book, but there's sort of no privacy because they're all so close together, all so thin. So we know that Maud hears basically every conversation that hears. So then her choice of what to repeat is so important. Talk to me about sculpting that voice and finding the curation side of her dialogue.
Maud, I adore Maud. Maud is different to her sister, so they're identical in looks but completely different in personality, ambition, everything you can possibly think of. Maud, I won't even attempt to use modern language to describe Maud, but people will come to understand her in their own way. But in her own time, Maud would have been considered special in some way. She doesn't communicate the way other people communicate. She does only communicate in echoes, if you like, of other people's language, but it's not meaningless.
Yeah.
And like other sort of subtle themes throughout the book, you need to be able to translate what she says to understand her meaning. Mm. And only a few people can do that very effectively, but she only says the truth, which is rare amongst all of us, really. And she chooses the phrases and words that she uses very carefully, even though it might not always seem so. You called her voiceless, and in some ways she is. To most of the people around her, she is voiceless. She doesn't have a voice. But to the people closest to her, it's always quite clear what she thinks and means. And I kind of had her as a bit of a truth teller through the whole book. And I was interested in this idea of a character who had very little voice and yet whose meaning was so important. You have to pay attention to understand her experience and to understand what she means. And I suppose in some ways that's just a metaphor for how we have to pay attention to the voiceless and the quiet, if we are to understand their experience and learn from it and improve things.
Yeah.
And that's Maud's role. But her role goes further than that. You know, I didn't want to use her personality and the type of person that she is as a trope. She wasn't, if that makes sense. I didn't want to simplify who Maud is, and she's far more complex, I hope, than you might realise at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I'll let people get to know her themselves.
Forgive me as one of our guests in studio groans as I drag this over to crime fiction, but I did really love the way that Maud also fits something that I know so well from crime fiction, which is, as you say, a truth teller character who is innocuous but always the sort of secretly most important character in a book. And I love the way that you use that, because one of the big themes in this book, dragging us back to chapter 17, is censorship. Mm. Because right before Mr. Hart is given that gift, we get the first letter from Tilda, who is also a character from Dictionary of Lost Words, that has been blacked out by military censors.
Mm.
And I loved this as like a thesis statement, because it reflects on something that Gareth and Esme go through in the Dictionary of Lost Words. And I wanted to ask why it was so important that censorship is key to the journey of someone like Peggy, whose job is seeing words and books in their raw form. There's like such a big contrast there, and that's so interesting to me.
Actually, censorship was a really interesting theme for me too. So at the beginning of World War One, the British government brought in the Defence Against the Realm Act, and that meant that they could pass laws around what information could and couldn't be shared with the public. So newspapers were really hamstrung in terms of what they could report about the war, and so were other people and organisations. And the army had a policy of censoring letters home to family. Now, I can totally understand censoring out information that gives the whereabouts of operations and so on that might, you know, because it might create danger for people during the war, but they also censored information that indicated the conditions in the trenches. So they didn't want the general public to be demoralised by the experience of men at the front. They didn't want people to lose support from the public for the war. And so they censored just basic information when men were expressing their experience. That was really interesting to me. And that's a really obvious kind of censorship situation. But I was also interested in self-censorship and structural censorship, if you like, or structural barriers to access to knowledge. And this is what Peggy experiences. So at that time in England, women still didn't have the vote. They didn't have a voice, literally, in Parliament. And that's something they were fighting for. But they did pull back on that campaign during the war. The suffragettes in particular struck a deal with government and said they would pull back on their kind of activities, which were often illegal, and in exchange for having women released from prison, but also in exchange for coercing young men into signing up for the war. So the White Feather campaign that some people might be familiar with, while it wasn't actually the idea of the suffragettes, they took it on. So they were the foot soldiers for that campaign. So it was suffragettes who would give out white feathers to men who didn't have uniforms on. But that wasn't across the board in terms of the suffrage movement. There were quite a variety of views on the war. So while that suffrage movement did pull back, what happens during the war is still, and before the war, women still didn't have access to education in the same way that men did. So even though women could go to university, at Oxford and Cambridge at least, they couldn't graduate with a degree. So they could get the learning, but not the qualification. And that's if you were a woman of means. But a woman like Peggy was encouraged to leave school at 12, you know, there were opportunities for women like her to go to high school, but money was always a barrier to further education. But not just money, the system created barriers. And one of the things that Oxford University and other universities had was a prerequisite to get into university was ancient Greek. Mm. And ancient Greek was really only taught at the private boys' schools. So women of means had to have special tutors to teach them Greek if they wanted to get into university. But women like Peggy, I mean, there was just no way that, you know, there's no reason for her to learn ancient Greek. And so she didn't. And so there's all these barriers, systemic barriers, which I think of as a little like censorship. And then the other, you know, there's another thread in the book, which is around translation.
Yeah.
So literal translation of one language to another, ancient Greek to English, for instance, but also the translation of information about what's going on in the war, or what's going on with the Spanish flu, those sorts of things.
Well, yeah, I mean, talking of that translation, one of the big things in the book is the Belgian refugees who come over at the start of the war. It's this amazing scene where as they're coming off the train and Peggy is just kind of looking around at the people welcoming them being like, you're really doing this for yourselves, aren't you? Yeah. And I just love the power of that because then we get to see her struggling with her self-criticality of, am I doing the same thing when she goes to then help out with the soldiers coming back from the war. And she gets drafted to go talk to officers, including Belgian officers who have come back because they think that she has good French when maybe
she fudges that one.
Yeah. And I just love the way that, talking of self-censorship, so much of this book, Peggy is saying one thing and then narrating another.
I'm glad you noticed that.
But then when we get to her talking to the Belgian officers, because if she tries to use that same self-censoring nuance that is very common and comfortable in your native language, trying to say that to a non-native speaker doesn't make sense. Mm. She has to like lower her own walls. Talk to me a little bit about those characters, the Belgian characters and people coming back from the war, and why it was important for Peggy to be able to open up to outsiders like that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, the other interesting thing about writing this book is as I was writing about Germany invading Belgium, Russia invaded Ukraine, and then, you know, Belgium refugees fleeing to England and being welcomed with open arms, which isn't the case with a lot of refugees, but it was the case with the Belgians, just as it was with the Ukrainians. But then, of course, things start to change once refugees are in a country for a long time. But when Peggy meets some of these Belgian soldiers who are being treated in Oxford, yeah, it's like, I mean, so many of us have travelled and had to communicate to people for whom English is not the first language. And you can't use that nuanced language, and English is full of it.
Mm-hmm.
We're always saying things we don't mean. We're always being very polite as well. I've met a lot of German people who are much more forthright because in their own language they don't have that same kind of euphemistic traditions in their language. And so they can appear quite forthright in English, but it's also very refreshing because you kind of know exactly what they mean.
Yeah.
And so she has to communicate in a much more honest way. And that results in a close relationship with one of the Belgian soldiers.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting too because we also get to see something similar happening with Maud, where Maud's relationship with language and that same language barrier with Belgian refugees lets her open up and get along really well there. And I think it's a really powerful moment of like understanding people's value beyond the presumptions that we make, which really is like a huge thing for people in general, but at this time, the women in this situation, the presumptions that we make about them are so huge. And I guess bringing Tilda back as a character is so fascinating in that light because she serves to, as a suffragette, go in and try shatter those presumptions. Why was Tilda the character that you felt was most fitting to link Dictionary of Lost Words and The Bookbinder of Jericho in that very straightforward way?
So, I mean, I adored Tilda, but Dictionary of Lost Words was not her story.
Mm.
And in fact, most books are written about women like Tilda all the time.
Yeah.
You know, this fiery suffragette, the woman that has a voice and uses it strongly. And I have actually never really wanted to write about those women. I've wanted to have those women on the sidelines, if you like, and focus on women who actually are probably less likely to have a voice or less likely to want to put themselves out there. And yet I still love Tilda, and I actually did seed this story in the previous story. It's so subtle, so people probably don't notice it. But there is a point when Tilda is in Oxford in Dictionary of Lost Words staying with friends on a narrowboat, and these are those friends. But I wanted another letter writer in this book. So in the previous book, Edith Thompson was the letter writer. Because they're both written in first person, there's a lot that Peggy in this book can't know.
Mm.
And therefore the reader can't know because Peggy doesn't see it or experience it.
Well, the other thing is too that Tilda is the letter writer, but we don't get to see Peggy's responses. There are so many moments where we're kind of having to infer those responses, and I'll let you continue, but I do have a point to make about that once you kind of get through this thought.
Yeah, but it was important for me to write. I was writing about World War One in a way, but for me it was the backdrop to the lives of these women. But I still wanted to have a woman's experience of war at the front.
Mm.
Not that Tilda was a VAD, a volunteer nurse in Etaples in France, which was a massive army base, British army base. So she wasn't quite at the front, but she saw the results of what was going on at the front when she nursed soldiers. And so I did want to have a bit of the war fed into the story of Peggy and Maud. And that was a great way to do it. Tilda as a character, who we got to know in the first book, it's just she's the most likely person to do that sort of thing, to sort of – she's an aging actress, so she can't get work. I think at some point she says she's only offered kind of, nanny or old whore kind of – that's what she's offered for parts. And so she decides to volunteer and become a nurse, and she can because she has no obligations. She's got no children. She doesn't have a job like Peggy has. And so she's in a situation where she can actually volunteer and leave the country. And so I really enjoyed writing her character and bringing the war back to Oxford through her letters, but also exploring the effects of war on women who volunteered, particularly who volunteered in France, in a way that doesn't happen very much in war literature because we focus so much on the men's experience. So Tilda does that.
The thing I was going to say, which I thought was really incredible, is there's this moment when Tilda realizes that she's been censored and she's like, all right, well, I'm going to work my way around that. I'm going to send it through the French post instead. And I absolutely love the way that she in that moment critiques the censorship process and says, do these military goons not understand what not having their suffering responded to by their families does to the soldiers' mental state? And then the way that you've shown that to us by Peggy's letters to Tilda not being in the text. So we're sort of having to figure out what Peggy's writing as we go. But then also the way that Tilda being the one writing the letters connecting the front back to Oxford is the exact inverse of Peggy's volunteering to help soldiers write their letters back home in the hospital. Like you've used letters in this book. Shocking, Pip Williams using the power of text to tell a story. you've used letters incredibly in this book to like link all of these concepts together as like some sort of postal system connecting all of these people together. It's crazy.
Wow. This is so meta.
I know.
This is great. Yeah. And actually, I'm actually a letter writer.
Yeah.
So letters are really important to me. I have a really dear friend in Canada who I met traveling, 25 years ago. And we write to each other a couple of times a year. And it's the biggest joy. And we very rarely send emails or, you know, any other kind of electronic text. Mm. There is something very unique about writing a letter because you can be completely uncensored in a letter because in a way there's nobody in front of you judging you as you write. And I find this in my own letter writing, my friend Lisa, and in the letters I get back from her. They're incredibly emotionally deep. We talk to each other about things we might not talk to anybody else about, and there's something safe about the distance between you in terms of geography and time, you know. And so I really love letters. I think they're really important, but at the time that I'm writing, they were the only form of communication. And we forget that, you know, they couldn't pick up a telephone, particularly my characters, and ring each other. So letters were everything. And because they were everything, the postal system was incredibly efficient. So, you know, people would get a postal delivery three times a day in the United Kingdom at that time. And letters from the front were quite efficiently delivered back home. So it was, you know, not quite real time, but it was a really good way to keep up with what was going on.
You mentioned much earlier the graves near Oxford, which many of the scenes with Bastion, who becomes the love interest later in the book, are set with. And this really powerful idea of linking love with death, because obviously in the Dictionary of Lost Words, we have the very harrowing conclusion to Esme and Gareth's relationship, very sudden, and almost the inverse start to Bastion and Peggy's. And just this wonderful scene of them sitting on a woman's grave and talking about what it means to be the only ones remembering her in that space and how their love, both emotional and physical, blossoms in this really strange, morbid setting. Talk to me about that parallel.
Yeah.
Why was that so fascinating to you?
Well, there are probably a few things to say. War, we haven't gone through a war. Our generation hasn't experienced the intensity of that on our doorstep. But from what I've read heard, war threatens your mortality. Mm. And when your mortality is threatened, you behave differently. So, in fact, it was really not uncommon for young people to sort of break away from the social mores of their upbringing around sexuality and class and all of those sorts of things. Because their life was threatened, they were more likely to fall in love. Mm-hmm. They were more likely to have sex out of marriage. They were more likely to take risks that they wouldn't have taken before war. And it is the spectre of death that creates a vitality in living, if you like. And so Peggy and Bastian are, I suppose, enacting that. And the St. Sepulchre's is the, I think I've said that right, it's the cemetery in Jericho. Yeah. And it's a real cemetery. And so I have spent a lot of time in that cemetery. And in fact, the where they sit, the person's, it's a, what's it, a sarcophagus.
Yeah.
So it's a, an above ground.
Big flat stone.
Yeah, yeah. Flat stone. And she's a real person. Mm. So she's a real person in that cemetery. It was important for me to have them around death because Peggy isn't around death. Mm. She comes to realize that she hasn't had the experiences of these new friends that she's made. There's Bastian, but there's also a Belgian refugee called Lot who she works with at the press. And she realizes that they have gone through unimaginable trauma.
Yeah.
And in a way, putting them in the cemetery is getting her closer to some of that trauma because Bastian has to deal with his dead.
Mm.
And the way he deals with his dead is through engaging with the dead in that cemetery in some way. And they and so that cemetery becomes incredibly important to Bastian. And I won't sort of go into why, but it's a really important place for them because rather than it being a morbid setting, it's a kind of release, life-giving setting, I suppose.
And I think that's something that Peggy's so fantastic at as a character in terms of understanding like the real context of things. And as she slowly comes to like move in and conquer her fear of her mother's spaces on the Calliope, but also this wonderful scene where one of their friends, Jack Roundtree, goes off to war. Everyone else is giving him these lovely gifts and they just give him a toilet roll.
Yeah.
And how much that means to him. I love just the authenticity of the townie getting it more than the gownie.
Yes. Yeah. And there is, you know, that's another one of those divides that is broken down a little bit in war is, and that's still a term that's used in Oxford today, town and gown. Peggy meets and has more access to people, I suppose, who are part of the gown set. Because when you start volunteering during a war, everyone's volunteering. Mm. And so you come across people who you would never have met in a previous life. And that opens up some opportunities for Peggy that she would never have had access to prior to that.
I guess the last thing I wanted to ask before I let you go is Esme and Gareth both appear as well, just for fleeting moments in this book. Mm. How did it feel coming back to those characters when I guess this isn't really their story?
No. It was great. Esme's barely in it at all, but she is a presence.
Mm.
Whereas Gareth does have a few scenes, and I probably like lots of people who read Dictionary. So there's a scene in Dictionary which just for your records,
mm-hmm.
I cried writing it because I didn't know it was going to happen until I wrote it. And so I was a kind of blubbering mess when I realised what needed to happen to Gareth. And so in many ways it was lovely to bring Gareth back.
Mm.
And of course, these two novels they overlap in time. So I haven't messed with his timeline in any way. It's just that this book starts at the beginning of World War I.
Mm.
And Gareth was a compositor in the press. And so it made perfect sense that he would know Peggy and that perhaps they would, work together in some way. And I really enjoyed that because also that was something that I didn't explain in the other book because it wasn't Esme's story. It was something Esme couldn't have known about. Whereas in this story, it's from the perspective of a bindery girl.
Yeah.
And so it was, I could write the backstory in a way to elements of the storyline in Dictionary. And I loved it. Yeah. I really loved it.
No, it was fantastic seeing these worlds overlap and also like not feeling the sequel burn, you know. I come from the world of crime fiction and the sequel burn is real. So this has been an absolute treat. And Pip, thank you so much for joining us here on Final Draft to talk about The Bookbinder of Jericho and congratulations on the release.
Oh, thanks, Felix. It's just been such a pleasure. And you are really the consummate, reviewer and interviewer. It was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Final Draft here on 2SER 107.3. Andrew, thanks for having me once again. Back to you.
Andrew dropping back in here again. That is it for this great conversation between Felix Shannon and Pip Williams. Pip's new novel is The Bookbinder of Jericho. Go check it out wherever you get your books. I hope it's a cute independent bookstore like my local. Thank you also to Felix Shannon for bringing us that conversation. You can check out Felix every Sunday night on the Death of the Reader show, or go and check out the Death of the Reader podcast wherever you're listening to this podcast. Just go, just subscribe. Unravel a murder mystery with the boys every 3 weeks. I highly recommend. Final Draft is recorded on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel, except for today, it was Felix Shannon. Stay in touch. You can find Final Draft on the socials. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. It means a new book chat, a new Final Draft every single week. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm going to be back very soon with more great conversations from incredible Australian authors here on Final Draft. Till then, happy reading. Bye for now.